The last couple of Sunday evenings, we've been talking about the flood of Noah's day. And we have mentioned how the first 11 chapters of Genesis are some of the chapters and accounts that are the least believed, even by many so-called religious people. You know, I find it hard to believe that people who claim to believe the Bible don't believe all of it. Because it's either all right or it's not. You know, it's not, well, parts of it might be true and parts of it might not be true. It's either all true or it's false. You know, you and I don't have the privilege of believing what we want to believe. Jesus believed in the account of Noah. We read that a couple weeks ago. He even referred back to it. The apostles referred to the account of the flood of Noah's day, and Peter based the end of the world upon what happened back during the times of Noah. So if the flood of Noah's day isn't true, if it's not an historical fact, then much of the Bible is not true itself. And how sad that is for people to believe it. But that's what many people believe. We looked at the beginning of the flood in Genesis chapter 6 and why God had to send the flood. Because people had gotten to the point where their thoughts were just evil continually. All they thought about was sin. All they thought about was wickedness. It was continual. No doubt many people by that time had become atheists. They didn't believe in God anymore, because if they had believed in God, they certainly would not be acting like that. So really, we find the people of Noah's day in many regards being very similar to our society and our culture. If you go look at many people in our society, or people in a number of countries, especially Europe, the continent of Europe, it's become a very atheistic continent. They have some of the most beautiful church buildings, cathedrals in the world, but yet hardly anyone worships there. And again, how sad that is, but it's true. And of course, one of the main reasons for the lack of belief in Europe is the fact that people stopped believing in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. When you stop believing in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, why believe in Genesis chapter 12, story of Abraham? Why believe that? Why cut it off at Genesis chapter 11? See, it's just a downhill slide. Once you start discounting the beginning of the Bible, then there's no end. And that we see has happened in a lot of places throughout the world. Began with Genesis 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, 6, 7, 8. And then it just kept going. Well, the book of Genesis is just a myth. Well, if Genesis isn't true, then what about the rest of the books of the Bible? See, there's no stopping point. Once you stop believing in part of the Bible, there's no place to stop. You end up becoming an atheist. You end up becoming someone that doesn't believe in the Bible at all. And that, of course, is where millions and millions of people are today. So it is extremely important, not only that we believe those first 11 chapters, but that we're able to teach other people why they are necessarily true. Very, very important for us. Because many so-called religious people don't believe those chapters anymore. So we have a great responsibility to be able to teach the truth of Genesis chapters 1 through 11. The flood has started. The animals have been gathered. The rains have came. The fountains of the earth were broken up. It has been raining on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Noah and the other seven are safely in the ark along with the animals. And the waters have been prevailing. Remember, as we talked about last week, they prevailed 15 cubits above the highest mountain. We also mentioned how the topography, the geology and so forth of the pre-flood world was greatly different than what we see today. In other words, if we were living in Noah's day in his part of the world and we would go out and look at it, it looked very different before the flood than it did after the flood. Very, very different. The psalmist refers to this in Psalms 104. It's not the only place, but it's one place. Psalms 104. Let's turn and read a couple verses there. Psalm 104, and we'll begin in verse 5. Psalm 104, verse 5. This is a psalm about the creation and parts of the creation. And we'll only read a few verses, but Psalm 104, beginning in verse 5. Praising God for Him creating the world and how He created it. Psalm 104, beginning in verse 5, says, "You who laid the foundations of the earth, so that it should not be moved forever. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys, to the place which you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth." Now, this is a direct reference to the waters of the flood. The mountains were made in such a way after the flood, so that they have formed a boundary, as the psalmist says, for the waters. And we'll see in Genesis chapter 8 where that begins to happen and how it happens. And we'll mention a little bit of the scientific processes that causes that to happen, what God used to bring that about. So let's begin Genesis chapter 8. Let's read the first five verses to begin. Genesis chapter 8, verse 1. "Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen." Now we're starting to see the end of the flood. Remember, the waters kept increasing and increasing and increasing. Well, now they've stopped. And what does God do? He sends a great wind to pass over the earth. And of course, this would primarily do two things, as you know from being out in the summer heat. What does the wind do? Causes things to evaporate. So number one, the wind would cause waters to evaporate, to go back into the atmosphere. And number two, the wind pushed the waters back. Now remember, mountains are much, much bigger now. Valleys are much, much deeper. And so by pushing the waters back, as the psalmist says, it goes back into those boundaries so they can't come back and cover the earth anymore. So the wind kind of had a twofold effect here that God used to push the waters out of the way as well as evaporating some of the water also. So this, of course, was supernatural. So God is starting to calm things now. You know, during those 40 days and 40 nights, and then as the waters prevailed, we mentioned where there would have been giant tidal waves and tsunamis all over the planet. You know, volcanoes would have been erupting both above ground, underground, and so, you know, just massive changes in the surface of the earth. And so God sends the wind to basically put the waters back where He wants them to be now. So again, the world looked very, very different when Noah looks out later. The rain stops. The fountains of the deep are stopped up. The waters begin to recede. Then the ark, on the 17th day of the seventh month, rests on the mountains of Ararat. And it doesn't say a particular mountain. And you go today to that area of Turkey where you would find the mountains of Ararat. They also go into Russia and I think maybe some into Iran, but in that part of the world is where the mountains of Ararat are today. And those mountains today are I don't remember, 15, 17,000 feet high, something like that. So here we have the ark resting on I would assume the highest of those mountains. That would seem to make sense, because he can't see any of the others. So he would, it would seem to be obvious that he's resting on the highest of those mountains. And that's where the ark is. So the waters continue to decrease for another 3 months. And then in the 10th month, he can start to see tops of other mountains. You know, he's resting on one mountain and can't see it, of course, because he's on top of it. But then he starts to see other peaks in that area. And, of course, there's been numerous efforts to find some sort of a relic of the ark in that part of the world. Of course, there's a number of reasons why that would be difficult even in the best of times, is because look at the nations you're around. Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Not the best places over the past 100 years to go looking. Plus, it's a very harsh environment. So you put all that together, and you're not going to get a lot of attempts to go over and find anything. Is there anything to find? Well, the Bible doesn't say. So we have no idea if there's anything there or not. A lot of people, of course, have said there were things there, but that's all. This was a great place for the ark to land, because the mountains of Ararat at that time would be a great place for people to disperse and the animals to disperse in all directions. So I think we again see God's providence involved in this. Then, beginning in verse 6, he says, "So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made." So he had, when he started to see the tops of other mountains, then he waits another 40 days. And what does he do? He opens the window of the ark. Okay? Then he sent out a raven. Okay, a raven, of course, these are scavengers, so they could eat carcasses of dead animals and so forth. So he sends out a raven which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up. A raven could find any type of things. And of course, at this time, if you can imagine all the debris that's floating around. I mean, debris just would be everywhere. So a raven wouldn't have any trouble finding a place to rest or finding anything to eat. Well, he also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. Well, a dove, very different type of bird than a raven. So a dove, he sent it out to see what the waters were like. So what happens? But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Wasn't any place for the dove to perch or to sit. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her into the ark to himself. It still wasn't good enough land, you know, it wasn't a proper environment for people to go out. So what does he do? He waited yet another 7 days. And again he sent the dove out from the ark. Now the waters are continuing to recede. Okay, they're continuing to recede. They're going out. The water's getting shallower and shallower. So what happens? Well, he sends the dove out. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth, and Noah knew that the waters had receded from the earth. They were receding. Now they had receded to the point where there were apparently some bushes, some, as he says, a freshly picked olive leaf. So now there are places where a dove could go and pick one. What does he do? Waits another 7 days, verse 12. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him anymore. So now it's getting to the point. He had sent the dove out. Now the dove didn't have to come back. The dove had places to go. It could find a place to perch and to live, basically. So, verse 13, "And it came to pass in the 601st year," remember he had went in the 500th year, "in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry." Not bone dry, as we'll see, where you could get out and walk through it easily, but he was actually able to see ground now. Probably extremely muddy, but still he could see the ground. I mean, it was there. So then in the second month, okay, he waits almost 2 months now. On the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Now, this is a different word in Hebrew at the end of verse 14. This means like you could walk on it, dry and firm. But in verse 13, it was still muddy and sloshy and so forth. But the end of verse 14, it says the earth was dried, means it was dry and firm. The animals could walk on it. People could walk on it. It was safe to walk on. It was good enough that people could actually walk on. So, then God spoke to Noah, saying, we don't know if God spoke to Noah during the flood. I assumed he did. It never says he does, though. But at this point, it says God spoke to Noah. What did he say? It's time. Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. He says, okay, Noah, it's now time to leave. It's time for you. You've been in this ark for a year. It's time for you to be gone. Time for you to get out. So bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every animal, every creeping thing, every bird and whatever creeps on the earth, according to their families, went out of the ark. So he takes everything. He commands Noah, clear the ark out. Okay, clear it out. Take everything, all the animals and everybody that's been there, and leave the ark. The ark served a purpose, and now there's no more need for it. So what does Noah do? Well, Noah builds an altar. So Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. This is the first specific mention of an altar. Now, this is amazing because the world's been around, what, at least 1,500 years by now, 2,000 years or more. It's the first time it's mentioned that there is an altar. And so he begins by doing what? Worshiping. That's the first thing he does. You know, he gets everybody out and everything out. And what does he do? He builds an altar. Builds an altar. And begins to do what? He takes of every clean animal. Remember, he took more clean animals than he took unclean animals. So he took every clean animal and every clean bird, one of each kind, and or of each kind, and then offered them on the altar. This may have been why he took a lot more clean animals than he did unclean animals. And notice what it says in verse 21. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. The Lord smelled a soothing aroma. He accepted that offering. You know, throughout the Bible, there's that phrase of the idea of a sweet-smelling aroma going to God. You know, our worship today is likened to a sweet-smelling aroma. Paul uses that phrase in 2 Corinthians to refer to us as Christians and how we live and how we worship, and it goes up to him as a sweet-smelling aroma, a sweet-smelling sacrifice. Well, that's what it says about Noah's sacrifice. It was accepted. So the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Doesn't say from the time he was born. You know, many people teach that, but that's not what this says. Evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night, shall not cease. We have in these verses an unconditional promise. Okay, there's no conditions attached to that. It says, as long as what? While the earth remains, as long as this planet we're living on is here, there's always going to be a time for planting and a time for harvesting. There's always going to be cold and there's always going to be heat. There's always going to be winter and there's always going to be summer. There's always going to be day and there's always going to be night. That's an unconditional promise. We'll never get to the point where the whole planet is in a winter type environment. Never. God says He's not going to ever allow that to happen. That's an unconditional promise right there in that verse. Also, there'll never be a time when this whole planet is like a summer, where it's heat all the time. Not going to happen. That is an unconditional promise. You and I will never see that day. God says, I will not let it happen. This is an unconditional promise. It'll never always be day. It'll never always be night. There will always be seasons. There will always be a time to plant and a time to harvest. God promises that. He makes that as an absolute, unconditional promise. Something we should take to heart, I think. I mentioned at the beginning, and I'll mention it in closing, that Peter, in his second epistle, alludes to the significance of the flood and what it did. And I want to close. This will kind of be our invitation as well. Beginning in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. After talking about the flood and what the flood did, in verse 7 of 2 Peter chapter 3, but the heavens and the earth which are now preserved by the same word are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Time has no meaning to God. None whatsoever. He doesn't exist in a world where time passes. The Lord's not slack concerning His promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? See, he goes back. He refers to the flood, Peter does. Remember what the flood did. What God's going to do with fire is even far greater. God's going to completely dissolve the world. The world in Noah's day wasn't totally destroyed or dissolved or annihilated. Life almost was, down to 8 people. But he says, at the end of time, God is going to destroy it all. Everything, every planet, star, moon, everything. There's not going to be a universe anymore. That's what Peter says. So Peter says, in light of that, in light of the fact that here is the God who is able to do that in an instant, how should you then live? That's what his conclusion is. How should you live? Should you live honoring Him? Should you live in preparation of that day? Because most people don't. Peter says, you should. How should you conduct yourself in holiness and godliness? Well, you should live knowing that one day is going to be that day that God destroys the entire universe. He says that's the point he's making. Live in light of that day. Because nothing else matters. Ultimately is, when it's all over, how have you lived? That's what he says is important. How have you conducted yourself? tonight, David's going to lead us in a song. Think about how you have conducted yourself in holiness and godliness. If you need to be baptized, if you need to respond, if you need to ask for forgiveness and prayers, do so as we stand and sing this song.